Hey, yo, what is a cypher?
Like, there'd be pimps on the corner with bitches, and I'd be putting up stickers and posters for, like, Big L and, like, doing street team shit.
The knowledge of the cypher is to enlighten you.
Where you think the cypher come from? The gods.
Because you tried to jump the cypher, and it goes this way.
Welcome to The Cypher, a weekly podcast bringing you talks with the most interesting figures in hip-hop and culture. I'm your host, Sean Sotero. This is episode 226 with Static Selecta. DJ Static Selecta has been on his grind since he first started DJing in his very early teens. He made a name for himself as a mixtape DJ, but really broke out once he started making beats on his own. Static has released 7 solo albums, with the latest, 8, coming out this Friday, December 8th. Those records have featured guest appearances from almost everyone in hip-hop, from Kool G Rap and Bun B to Smoke DZA and 2 Chainz. In addition, Static has released collaborative albums with Bumpy Knuckles, Terminology, Freeway, King Crooked, Freddie Gibbs, and others. As an artist and producer, Static has played an important role in the careers of Mac Miller, Action Bronson, and countless other up-and-coming stars. And he has had a special role as a big brother for Joey Badass and his pro-era crew, serving as the collective's tour DJ for years and producing many of their best-loved songs. We met up with Static Selecta at his studio, Harley Harl's House of Hits, in Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like The Cypher, please check out our Patreon at patreon.com/thecyphershow. Every new patron helps bring Josh a little closer to buying that one-on-one cooking lesson from Action Bronson. If you want to know about any of the songs we're playing during this episode, visit thecyphershow.com to find a complete list and the show notes. While you're there, sign up for our monthly newsletter to stay on top of what's going on with The Cypher. And now, here's the man who really, really wants you to spell his name right, Static Selecta.
Really, the biggest thing I want to know is how the hell you managed to DJ on Lansdowne Street for that long and still be alive.
Lansdowne Street is a street in Boston that borders Fenway Park. As a result, it also has been home to numerous bars and nightclubs over the years. The mix of drunken sports fans and drunken clubgoers can make the area very interesting.
I've seen a lot of craziness on Lansdowne Street. I was actually thinking about that a couple of nights ago. I seen, like, probably some of the wildest shit ever in my life. Like, one time I saw a dude get dropped outside of, it was like a hardcore show, and the dude's head hit the ground, and they, like, went to lift him up, and, like, his skull, like, part of his skull, like, stuck to the ground. It was crazy. I seen another dude, it was like a gang fight in the parking garage right across from, like, Bill's Bar, and, this guy walked out just like with white meat hanging out of his, like he got cut up. It was, I've seen some crazy shit on Lansdowne. This is all at a young age too, like 17, 18, 19.
Right, right. Because you started DJing even before that.
Yeah, I started when I was 13, but yeah. I started doing clubs when I was 15.
Jesus. I just remember that Axis, Bill's Bar, you know.
Avalon. Karma. Like, Karma was my spot.
Yeah, those were some pretty intense.
Now it's like the House of Blues and like all kinds of like, it's cool, but Lansdowne's dead compared to what it used to be.
Yeah. As a New Englander, you are directly the reason that the Red Sox went so long without winning World Series, right? We can trace that.
Oh, it's funny. We could trace that. Do you know into the story behind that?
Just the broad outlines, but I'm sure our listeners don't. So why don't you?
My great uncle taught Babe Ruth how to play baseball. And they actually broke the curse the week I moved to the Bronx from Boston. Like, I moved from downtown Boston to a mile away from Yankee Stadium, and I went to Game 7, and the ball's right there on the wall. On the wall.
Oh, wow, there it is.
Shout out to Big Poppy.
Wow, so you were responsible for the beginning and the end of the curse.
Yeah, man, I own the Red Sox now. I'm just kidding. Now, I've seen some real crazy sports moments in my life, man, between the Celtics, the Bruins, the Patriots, the Red Sox. I'm kind of over it all now. Like, I'll always be a fan of all those teams. I'm excited about the Celtics this year. But, like, even with the Patriots now, I watch the games and I'm like, you know, I think we're going to go to the Super Bowl again. I'm not worried. Brady's the greatest. But I've seen so much that, like, last year's Super Bowl was... That was a moment.
Yeah. When the Patriots started winning, it seemed like it would never stop.
Yeah. It's a convenient city to be from when it comes to sports.
Yeah.
It's a hated city for sports.
So you had a record store there for a while.
Yeah, a year. I had a marketing company for years, but I had a record store called Crates open for a year. Basically, we would take like the excess stuff from the record pool we had. And then my partner, Eddie Q, shout to him. He had like 20,000 records in his mother's house and she had to get rid of them. So we went and took all his records and made a record store out of them. There were so many records and it went quick though. Like the stock quickly depleted. And then it lasted about a year. I moved to New York about, I think, a week or two after the store. Or I think the store closed after I moved, but it was like right around the same time.
Yeah. You'd spent your life in record stores up to that point. Were there any surprises in running one?
Nah, it's like we did it legit too. Like, you know, we'd order all the new CDs that came out. Like, I remember the G-Unit album came out while we were open. Jay-Z, the Black album came out while we were open.
Stunt 101.
Both G-Unit's Beg for Mercy and Jay-Z's The Black Album were released on November 14th, 2003.
Like, we had all the new CDs that came out. It was just, like, frustrating trying to make money off it because Best Buy is selling CDs for, like, $12, and it cost us $12 to even buy them.
I heard that same thing from guys in Houston that the independent stores there.
Best Buy really killed the record stores because they did that, and on top of it, as soon as all the other record stores disappeared, Best Buy stopped picking up all the CDs. So it was like... Like, I'm lucky now if my CD's in Best Buy. I think my new one is, obviously. My last couple albums have been in Best Buy, but it's still, like, a lot of cats don't even get their stuff in Best Buy.
Right, they pick just a handful.
Like, if I didn't have the major artists I have on my albums, like, I might not be in there.
Yeah, you started working at 13 years old, being on the radio.
WPEA, Exeter, New Hampshire. Yeah. It's actually at Phillips Academy, but I never went there.
Exeter Academy, established in 1781, is one of the oldest secondary schools in the country. Nearly a third of the graduates move on to the Ivy League. The poet Willie Perdomo, who you can learn about on episode 201 with Jay Smooth, used to teach there. Notable alumni include 1796 graduate Daniel Webster, Gore Vidal, Howard Hawks, Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers keyboardist Ben Montench, Fuji's adjacent musician John Forte, and some Zuckerberg guy.
Right. I know a lot of people have called you a prep school kid over the years and you get
that's
mad.
Hilarious. Yeah. That's hilarious. Anyone that's ever done that knows absolutely nothing about me. Like,
right.
I come from like a lower middle class family. Like I definitely did not go to Phillips Academy. anyone that goes there becomes like a doctor, a lawyer, like, you know, it's 40,000 a year. In the '90s, it was 40,000 a year it's a high school.
Right.
But basically I went to Exeter Area High School when my parents, you know, when we moved from Lawrence to, Lawrence area, we lived in Methuen. We moved to New Hampshire when I was 10 years old. So I went to like junior high school and high school there. And it was Exeter High is in the same town as Phillips Academy. So that's why people get confused. But they have to allow, I mean, I don't think it even exists anymore. But back then they had to allow like, I think 5 or 6 people from the area high school to have a show on Phillips because, you know, it's in our town. It was kind of like a thing. It was only fair. They didn't have to, but it was a thing. Like every semester, there would be like a couple papers up in the principal's office. Like, want to be on the radio? And I jumped right on it. Like, there was a couple. Actually, you know what's funny? Brennan Fredericks, who is one of the editors at Complex, he was also on the radio with me. He actually went to the school, but he went to junior high school with me as well. He was actually from the town, and I think his dad taught there, so he got to go to the school. Mm. And he was one of the other DJs. My man Tiger was there, and my man Dave, who was friends with Brennan. So we had like this hip hop clique, and my boy Bug Out and Doug would be on my show, who later went into they were in the group Granite State. Let's go. Granite State. Soon you'll see where the answer to the people is preparing for change. A lifetime in the making for the highs and lows, late nights and long days down in unpaid roads. So raise it up. But we all had like kind of competitive shows. My show was more like a Stretch and Bobbito, and they were playing like a lot of the more like mixtape stuff.
And what was your DJ name back then?
It was Shorty B, but then it turned to DJ Static, I think, in 97. So prior to 97, it was Shorty B, and then DJ Static in 97.
Oh, wow. Who gave you the Shorty B name?
I think I gave it to myself. Either me or my boy Bug Out, because I used to tag it. Like, we used to spray paint it on the walls and run from the cops and all that. But, you know, I grew out of that.
Because of your last name?
Yeah, Burrell, yeah. And, you know, then I had Static, and then I got into battle DJing, and I started to actually win a couple in the area, and I found out about two other DJ Statics, one from Philly, one from Brooklyn, and one from, I think, Norway. But he was, like, the big one. He was the one winning the DMCs and all that. Static.
Static. DJ Static is a Danish DJ and producer who has won the Pan-European DMC World DJ Championships. He was also voted Best Urban DJ 5 years in a row at the Danish DJ Awards.
So I was really aggravated. I was like, I got to change. I don't want to, like, I made a name for myself in the area. I didn't want to lose the Static, you know, with a K. I didn't want to lose it. And one day I was in high school. I did my first gig in New York City. We literally left school at 3 o'clock, got down to the Bronx. And I was doing this party in the South Bronx. And the guy on the mic's like, yo, what's your name? I was like, DJ Static. He's like, Static Selecta. And I was like, oh, shit, I like that. And that's how I got the name.
Nice.
Shout out to him. His name's Mr. Way of Life. I have not heard his name since, but that night he gave me my name. So shout out to him.
That's amazing. The thing about PEA was there's, at least when it comes to reporting, no such thing as high school radio.
Yeah, so I was reporting to CMJ and Gavin and all that. Now, here's another interesting thing. At the time, John Forte had just, I think he just graduated there. So, Staying Alive by Wyclef came out.
Just a rhymer, you still a small timer, hoping at the game, treat that ass a little kinda, every step tangled.
And that was like the only thing hip-hop connected to Exeter ever at the time. So it was like, oh shit, John Forte's on the record. And, I mean, ironically, he went to jail for, what, 10 years for selling coke later. That's a different story.
Fuji's affiliate John Forte was arrested in 2000 with possession of 31 pounds of liquid cocaine with intent to distribute. That's about $1.4 million worth. He was sentenced to 14 years but was pardoned by President Bush in late 2008 after a campaign led by, among others, singer Carly Simon and Utah Senator Orrin Hatch. Forte was acquainted with Simon because of her relative that was his classmate at Phillips Exeter.
Also, Mark Zuckerberg was going to Phillips while I was on the radio.
Oh, wow.
That's another thing people don't know. So Facebook was in its early ideas while I was playing. You know, he might have heard my show.
I want in. Facebook. You want your cut, man.
Yeah, man. Get
You mentioned you were from Methuen originally, next door to Lawrence. And there was a lot
of... The reason I say Lawrence in a lot of interviews is, one, I was born in Lawrence.
Right.
And two, my grandmother, like, watched me after school a lot. And their house was on, you know, it was an infamous house on Haverhill Street in Lawrence on Tower Hill. So, like, I technically was raised in Lawrence, even though my, you know, my address was never Lawrence. But Methuen's considered the greater Lawrence area. It's like saying Boston and being from, like, Quincy, you know?
Yeah. But there was a lot of hip-hop talent there, although you wouldn't become aware of it till a little later.
Yeah, I had no clue. But some of the kids I went to second, third, fourth grade with, I ended up meeting later on at, like, parties, like, later on in life.
Yeah, and some of them would be, a lot of them would be rappers.
Yeah, yep. I met Term when I was, like, 16 years old at a club I used to do. It was, like, an under-21 club.
Night of the living dead. I got my pen and my pad with me, writing down every word the people said.
Daniel Terminology Carrillo is a rapper who has worked with Static a ton over the years. They've even released two albums as a duo under the name 1982, the year they were born.
He always came for the open mic, and he was always talking shit. He's like, I want to battle Acrobatic and Mr. Lift and all the Boston guys. And I don't think he was ready for that at the time, but he was dope. So we started hanging out and, like, doing sleepovers in high school. And just, I'd wake up on, you know, his mom's floor and start going through records. And he had an ASR. Like, it was just all hip hop, man. Everything was just a love of hip hop.
Yeah. I was going to ask about Term, because he's, of all the projects you've done with rappers, and there have been a lot of them, he's the only one that you guys actually have a separate name. You have the group, you're billed as 1982.
Except Static King. Static King.
Oh, Static King is, yeah, I stand corrected, yeah.
Static Selecta.
We back with that real shit, that hardcore. Got you climbing up the walls like it's parkour.
Static King is Static's duo with King Crooked, a.k.a. Crooked Eye.
But what is it about Term? Why is that apart from a record you might do with Ransom or Freddie Gibbs or whomever?
I mean, he's there from day one. He was the one telling me my beat sucked when I was in high school, you know? So he was there literally from day one with Doug and Bug Out. Besides them, my man Ape, shout out to him too. But Term was the first one to, like, have a record out of all of us. He put out a 12. Well, Rex was technically, but I was closer with Term at the time. Term put out a record when, like, you know, I think he was, like, a couple weeks out of high school. Like, an actual record vinyl. And back then, having that was, like, you made it. Because if you put out a record, it would automatically make it to, like, Fat Beats and Newbury Comics and all that. Like, you made it, you know what I mean?
Yeah, that was it. Next thing you know, you're on stage at the Middle East, and where do you go from there?
Oh, man, yeah. I've probably done 100 shows there, maybe more.
Yeah, I definitely saw more than my share when I lived there. So you mentioned a couple of times you moved from Boston to New York. What was it, like 03 maybe around
04.
There? 04, okay.
I was always going to New York.
Right.
You know, like I literally would get out of the club in Boston and my man would be like, yo, you want to go to New York right now? I'd be like, why not? And we just go to New York. Like, I've been going to New York since I was like 15 years old consistently. I think about it now, and this kid's like, I watch a 15-year-old kid now, like his mom probably ain't letting him go from Boston to New York. And my mom was overnight. Cool. I used to think she was strict, but she let me go do a lot of cool ass shit.
Yeah.
Like she let me go stay with my cousin Billy, and he lived in Jersey City at the time, and like they were letting us do whatever the fuck we wanted to. We were drinking St. Ides all night and shit. And like looking back at it, it's like, you know what? My mom was cool. She didn't know what was going on, but looking now, like if these kids, like my daughter's 16, she ain't drinking no St. Ides.
I mean, who knows if Livian have St. Ides by then.
I'm surprised. They're still open, man. They sell in Bushwick.
Before you moved, the Boston scene of the late 90s, early 2000s.
Special.
Yeah. So who were some of the big, we've had Liff on the show.
Episode 97.
Yes. Liff, 7L, Esoteric, Acrobatic, man, the creators. I don't want to forget nobody because Ed OG obviously was he was like the god of it all.
Right.
Sheesh. Shout out to KT. Shout out to M Slash. Shout out to, I know I'm forgetting a lot of people.
And where would you play? I know there was the Middle East, Western Front.
Yeah, Middle East, Western Front, Bill's Bar.
Mm-hmm.
That was like the main spots. I'm going to forget. I mean, I was DJing the hood clubs, though. I was like in the River Street Cafe and, you know, all over the place. Phil's Corner, all up and down Columbia Ave, like from all over the place, man. I was DJing 6 nights a week. So that there was two different worlds. There was the Middle East world.
Right.
And then there was the spots getting shot up every night worlds, you know, the Theater District and Lansdowne and all that. Like, there was some craziness. The
Theater District was not very pretty back then.
I've seen crazy shit over there. Like, Combat Zone's right there.
Yeah.
I'm
talking about the Combat Zone.
The Combat Zone is the name for the area of Boston that, in the 1960s and 70s, used to be the Adult Entertainment District. Up into the early 2000s, the area still had a fair amount of crime and prostitution, even as it edged up against new development, a growing theater district, and college dorms.
So, I mean, I remember going to Dino's when I was like 17, and I actually met Tony Touch there, who's now like my brother-in-law. Like, I went to a club. Yeah, I went there when I was 17, and I remember just walking around. Like, my dad used to tell me stories about the Combat Zone, and now I'm like, you know, I moved to Boston literally before I graduated high school. I had my own apartment. And I just remember like rolling around the Combat Zone every night, dolo, like just going to clubs. And like my mom would be like, yo, you're crazy. I'd be like, hey, you know, I was on point.
Right. Yeah. You know, you don't quite stop to think about it.
Yeah. I mean, they respected it. Like the hustlers would be like, there'd be pimps on the corner with bitches. And I'd be putting up stickers and posters for like Big L and like doing street team shit.
Right.
And they respected it because they knew I was like, you know, different hustle.
They see you there every night. There was this time in which you jump into producing.
Yeah, later.
Yeah.
I was always doing it, but I never would like play my beats for any. I remember I played a beat for Akon in like 2002, 2003 before he blew up. He used to like come to the crib and I did his first mixtape actually for SRC and, you know, Locked Up had just come out. And I played, he was one of the first people to be like, yo, I like that beat, send it to me. And I had no way to send it because there wasn't no sending emails.
Right.
So I was like, how do I send it? He's like, mail me the CD. I was like, oh, I only have one copy. I didn't know what the hell was going on. And then I started getting placements. I did a KRS-One record and a couple songs of OC's album. And
the OC stuff, that was some of the first.
Yeah, I'm not too proud of that only because the beat, I mean, it was only an intro and outro, but my beats were not that good back then. But my cuts were, so it kind of saved the songs when I scratched over them.
Right. And you were also doing just scratches on some records when you were starting out, I think, right?
Yeah, I did a lot of scratches on like a lot of Brick Record stuff and I did cuts. I remember I did cuts on Mr. Lift's first EP. And like kids I went to high school with that used to hate would like hit me up on like AOL Instant Messenger and be like, yo, you did the cuts on Mr. Lift?
Is that the one with the monster lady on the cover?
Enter the Colossus.
Yeah.
It's funny because he spelled my name wrong in the credits. It wasn't his fault, it was Insights, but it's all good.
Amazing.
That started the Spell My Name Right movement.
DJ Static Selector, about to put the shit on the way it's supposed to be put on. And the name of this album, Spell My Name Right.
Oh, that was the beginning of
people fucking
using that name. Yeah.
Even on Rex's first album.
Oh, shit.
Yeah.
S-T-A-T-I-K. Selecta.
Like, that was my first placement ever. They spelled my name right. And that was my first placement, 2001. I was fresh out of high school. And just having a record in stores was so big for me. Like, I used to roll around with Rex like I was on tour with Nas.
I believe it. I wanted to ask about an early solo track, Did What We Had To Do.
We did what we had to do, be what we had to be, go where we had to go, see what we had to see, growing up, growing up, blowing up, blowing up, oh, fulfilling our fantasies.
Yo. Yeah, that wasn't that early. That was 2007. Mm. So that was right before my first album.
Yeah.
It's not a real song.
How do you mean?
It's a song that those three guys, it was Karis One, Large Professor, and Larry Chiba, shout out to him. He went by El the Head Toucher back in the day. He was like down with Landspeed and all that. But it was these three guys had a song with a label called Inebriated Rhythm. Shout out to Marlon. And Marlon gave me the acapella and I was like, yo, bro, let me remix that. Like, I want to use it. This is before I even thought of doing an album. And I put it on a mixtape. And then when I did my first 12-inch, I put that as like the third song on the 12-inch.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
But it wasn't real.
All right. Because I was going to
every other song on this album. Actually, there's one more song that's half real. I'm talking about Spell My Name Right, my first album. Because I ended up putting it as the bonus song on my album. There's a song called G Shit.
Out came the fifth, I squeezed in his face, a bullet came out of the clip.
I put Show Off Mix because I did that on the other one too. But this song is originally Sev One's featuring Jadakiss and Uncle Murder, and he paid them a lot of money to do the verses. So,
yeah, this that gangsta shit. This that motherfucking gangsta shit. Yeah, this kid was like Murder, you a gangster when you find time to rap. Cause that stuff you be talking about is actual fact.
I basically remixed that, and Sev and Term did their verses just for this version. So it's half real. But Jada and Uncle Murder really didn't do it for my album.
The reason I asked about Did What We Had To Do, although I guess this is not relevant now, is the idea of having Large Professor rap on one of your beats, but he didn't know he was originally rapping
on it. Yeah, he had no clue. He heard it, though. Like, they all heard it, obviously, like, later, but...
Right.
Yeah, that was one of... I was still in the... Clinton Sparks was, like, a big brother to me, and we used to always, like, get rare acapellas and just make fake songs. I did that so many times. That was the game, though. Everybody was doing that. Vlad and Green Lantern. Everybody was just taking unreleased acapellas and making fake songs. That was how it was going.
Yeah.
But by the time my album came out, the reason I put it album together is because the mixtape game crashed.
Right, because
the drama got arrested.
Right, something we've talked about a couple times talking to different mixtape people is the drama thing.
That and changed the whole world, bro. The hip-hop world, at least. It really changed a lot.
On January 16th, 2007, the Atlanta office of DJ Drama's affiliate mixtape group was raided by police. They confiscated cars, cash, recording equipment, and tens of thousands of CDs.
I was worried about where I was going to get money.
Yeah.
Because I was putting out mixtapes a couple times a month.
Can you give me an idea of how sudden the change was?
It was like, bung, you got a million texts. Like, yo, it just went down. And then you're on a website. Back then, all we had was like Hip Hop Game and All Hip Hop. And just reading the article, like, yo, Drama, Canon, Sense got arrested. They took 80,000 cash. They took like 100,000 CDs out of their office. They took all their presses. They never got the money or the CDs back, but they've never to this day been charged. How many years later? 10 years later?
Yeah.
So I was like, yo, I remember calling Clinton that day, and I'm like, bro, what are you going to do with Mix Unit? He goes, what is that? I don't know what that is. I'm like...
As Clinton Sparks well knew because he started it, MixUnit.com was at the time the world's largest urban e-commerce store. It specialized in mixtapes.
He made a couple million dollars off that shit, man. I don't want to hear that.
That's the thing that's wild about the drama arrest is in a day, the whole thing changed.
One day. Like, literally, you go to, like, Canal Street, ghost town.
Yeah.
And then a couple months later, some people try to keep going with it. But at that point, after that happened, if, like, you were, like, a mixtape DJ, the labels would be like, ah, whatever. We don't even need you. Everything changed.
Yeah.
That's when the blogs took over.
One thing from your mixtape days I did want to ask you about is that you premiered Black Republican, which is kind of mind-blowing.
Black Republican money I got coming in. Can't turn my back on the hood. I got love for them. Can't clean my act good. Too much tugging them. Nah. Probably in the back of the hood. I'm like,
I feel like a black militant taking over the...
Black Republican was the heavily anticipated 2006 collaboration between Nas and Jay-Z. It was the very first song the two stars had ever appeared on together and followed their famous years-long feud.
Yeah, how'd that happen?
That's a kind of a long story, but I'll never say who gave it to me, but he's a legendary DJ, and he gave it to me 6 months before I played it. So I was sitting on it for a while. And
Would you play it to friends? Like, hey, check this out.
Yeah, of course. Everybody bugged that fuck out. And it wasn't mixed or anything. It was like a rough mix. Mm. So one day, my man hit me. He's like, yo, let me get, you know, I know you've got it, bro. You can trust me. I've given you exclusives. Like, trust me. Just give it to me. So I give it to him. And he went on Shade 45. This is early Shade 45. Like, it was like 2 years old, maybe a year old. And all of a sudden, I go on a website. You know, there's a site I used to go to. I still go there this day, but it's like a private thing. And you go there, and they have like all the exclusives. Like nowadays, shit gets everywhere immediately. But back then, this is where you would go and get everything before anyone. So I go on there, and all of a sudden, I see Black Republicans. I'm like, oh, shit. I don't even think I knew the name of the song yet.
It's mistitled on your mixtape.
What does it say?
I feel the magic, baby.
This is what you made us do, huh?
Turn motherfucking lights down.
Young Big Mike, Static Selector.
Let's go, what up?
What up, homie?
I mean,
the sun still rising in the east, worldwide exclusive.
What you expected, ain't it?
Oh man, it's easy.
On Static and Big Mike's tape, The Sun Still Rises in the East, East Coast Slang Volume 1, the song is titled Black Militants.
Nah, you know what? Maybe it didn't say Black Republicans. It said like Nas and Jay-Z exclusive, and I was like, what the fuck? And I go on and I listen to it, and it's my man playing it on Shade 45, but he's talking all over it, like obnoxiously, to where like people can't even play the song because he's just really going in. So I'm like, fuck. Like, I gotta take advantage of me having this record. I call Big Mike, who was one of the biggest mixtape DJs at the time. I'm like, bro, I got the record. I think word started going around that I had it because I got so upset about it. And then he called me, you know, he's like, let's do a tape. I'm like, yo, I'm gonna use this as leverage and get mad exclusives. I think I got that CD here somewhere, but the track list was crazy. Like, we had like half a Clips album. It wasn't out yet, the second Clips album. We had like freestyles just for the tape. We had at least like 15 songs that no DJ in the world had. And we put out the mixtape the next day. And we must have moved like 20,000 in the first day.
Amazing.
That was like the end. That was the end of the mixtape game. So what happened after that is that ended up with being Nas being so cool. Well, first of all, you got to realize before that, I saw Nas. I was in the studio with Premier one time. And it was when the Scratch magazine had come out with Nas and Primo on the cover. And I was like, yo, everybody wants y'all to do the album, bro. I was like, hip hop needs this. Preem's like, yeah. I'm like, trust me. He's like, all right, I'm going to call Nas. No, he didn't even say that. He just like picks up his phone. He's like, where you at? Come through. I'm at the Stew. 5 minutes later, Nas walks in, like headquarters. He walks in and me and my man Doug are like, what is going on? And Nas is like, yo, what's up? I'm like, yo, Static Selector. Remember, he goes, yo, you did the mixtape. I did the Prophecy Volume 1. And he did drops for it and all that.
You're now tuned in to my man, Static Selector.
Static Selector.
This ain't your average mixtape.
Ladies and gentlemen, you heard it first.
Prophecy.
Nas, the longest.
But it was kind of like a fake mixtape where I took an interview he did while I was there. And I made it sound like a mixtape made
the
that way.
The only successful, credible MC to have this longevity. And every pound I get in the street is my award.
But anyway, he was like, yo, that's my favorite tape anyone ever did for me. I was like, wow, like, I appreciate that. So now fast forward, we put out that tape. This is like a year later. We put out that tape with the Black Republicans on it. The dude that originally played it on Shade 45 calls me and goes, yo, bro, I heard Nas is looking for you. If I was you, I wouldn't be in New York. I'm like, oh, here we go. So immediately I wanted to like get to the bottom of it. I called Nas's manager. I'm like, yo, man, I'm just like, before I could say anything, he's like, yeah, Nas is looking for you. I was like, word? I was like, well, and I was about to explain myself. And he goes, he wants you to do his new mixtape for like Def Jam. I'm like, word?
It's a very different,
so that worked out amazing.
For you than you
I did the
meant.
The Prophecy Volume 2, which was completely official, like done with Nas.
Call me the end. You lame ass niggas is fucking up the game. This is Nas with my man Static Selector.
Static
rest in peace. He's trying to kill me. I'm the leader. You can't stop me. It's the nastiest, flashiest.
And that was pressed up by Def Jam. They did over 80,000 CDs. Now, what's crazy is I went to Def Jam. Shout out to Sherry Bryant.
Sherry Bryant began her career at Rockefeller. During the period Static is mentioning here, she was a product manager at Island Def Jam who worked with artists like Nas, Jay-Z, and Fabulous. She is currently the general manager and a partner at Alamo Records.
I went upstairs, brought the master of the CD, and she gave me a check. It wasn't for me. I didn't get paid to do the CD. But I ended up getting mad props off it and like ended up, you know, selling a bunch in the streets. But she gives me a check for $40,000, not written to me, written to the dude that made the CD. Shout out to him. I'm not going to put him under the bus, but he's a big mixtape guy. He, you know, he duplicates CDs. So I bring she gives me the check and I go downstairs and give him the master of the CD and the check for $40,000 for 80,000 CDs, right? They're like 50 cents each when you bought that many. Bro, they never listened to the fucking CD. They gave me a check for $40,000 to print 80,000 CDs of a CD they never fucking heard. What if I was on there like, yo, check me out every Thursday night, Shay Fortune? What if I was like, yo, Terminology, new album out now. Not for nothing. I put Term on it. They didn't even know it. Like,
Shop a man, Terminology. SP. Look out for that new mixtape. Hood Politics 4.
Yo, get yourself a day, bro.
I could have done anything, bro. I could have been like, yo, new exclusive fucking Prodigy. I could have put anything I wanted on the tape. But I did. They knew I was going to do the right thing.
Yeah.
But I just couldn't get over that. Like, if I was giving someone $40,000, I'd be like, let me listen to that shit.
Yeah, amazing. What's the weirdest thing you've ever sampled?
Recently, I've been sampling a lot of, like, kids' cartoons. Like, not the music, but, like, sometimes the music. Like, say Tom and Jerry's on TV. My daughter's watching or whatever. I'll sample, like, some weird music from that and flip it. Or, like... a lot of Japanese animation lately. Like, I don't sample it from the TV, though. I sample it on my iPhone and then bring it to the studio and build around it. I've made snares out of Hennessy bottles. Like, when you pop, you know, for the first time when you take it off the airtight thing, it goes, boop. That's my favorite sound in the world.
Nice. You've said that you wouldn't sample drums from a rap record.
From a hip-hop song.
Yeah. And I know that that's the rule among producers.
I thought it was. Or it used to be. My whole life. They used to say it was. But now I talk to people like, I don't want to put nobody under the, you know.
Oh, come on. It's just us. No one's listening.
Yeah. No, like, even like Alchemist, I don't think he gives a fuck. He's told me a couple times. He'd be like, I've stolen a Primo snare and made it mine. Like, obviously he fucks with it or he layers it or he pitches it, but like, Kanye's known for stealing drums from hip hop records.
Really, I just like bit the drums off Explosive and put it like with a sped up sample, and now it's kind of like my whole style where it started.
I guess if you make it funky, man, you make it your own. I guess it doesn't matter, but
well, why?
I'm just against like taking
for
a loop.
You.
Like, don't take the loop from like One Love by Nas and make it your drums. That's corny,
right?
And I've seen people do that.
Why is that different than sampling a break from
a
non-hip-hop record?
Because a producer sat there and like crafted that the drum sound to sound the way they wanted it. And they took all that time to make it like that. That's like taking that's like if Chevy takes a Ford truck and like adds their logo and like paints it and calls it theirs. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, so it's like, it's one thing if you take a break from the 70s or 80s or 60s or whatever and you make it sound like thumping on some hip-hop shit. That's how hip-hop started. But taking it from someone that already spent all that time on it and not really doing nothing, that's kind of biting to me.
Yeah. Have you noticed other rules around producing and around making rap records change over the years?
All changed. I remember when people were like, yo, we don't sample, you know, it got to be from the 70s to sample it, or it got to be from like more than 10 years ago. Nowadays, like, people are sampling records a month after they come out. Like, look at something like Hands on the Wheel by A$AP Ferg. That's a sample, but who is it? It's Rocky and Schoolboy, my bad. That's a sample of a cover of Kid Cudi.
One more tune. It's a cover. Hands on the Wheel. Fuck that.
So it's like, that's the like newest shit you can sample, a cover of a new song.
Right.
When it came out, it was new at least.
One of the things that you do when sampling, you'll take well-known elements and disguise them. There's one Wes Montgomery tune that is a cover of a well-known pop song.
Yeah.
And once I knew that, the melody was recognizable, but in the context of the song, I wouldn't get, hey, this
Tom,
is...
The guy with the beard?
Yeah.
Let him know I'm sick and every flow is like a cancer. Cancer rooster, cut his fucking nuts off. Serve him for $100, sesame and plum sauce.
That was Dante Ross' fault. not his fault. He was like, sample this, and I sampled it. Oh, no, you know what? I'm sorry. No, it was Lord Sear.
Oh, okay.
We shot him on the song. Like, at the end of the song, Action goes, he goes, don't get seared by the Lord or some shit.
Yo, shouts to the Lord, man. Get seared up like fucking salmon. Brasileño.
It's like a shout out because he gave us the sample. Mm. Actually, on the vinyl of the album, Well Done, it says, special thanks to Lord Sear. Sear wanted to make sure he got his credit.
Yeah. How do you take a recognizable melody, even though it's not the best known version of the song, it's the vocal melody, and get it so that it's not...
It's all mathematics, really. I have a special number. I don't give it away. I might have once or twice, but it's a number I have that if you pitch a sample from the original speed to that, it stays in, like, in it's not like between, it stays in key, not that same key, but it stays in a perfect key. So like, you don't have to worry about, you know, playing with it. Like it basically stays in a key to play along with without pitching it weird. But that this is one number percentage that you put it to, and it gets to like the perfect speed and the perfect like tune. I can't even explain it. I don't even know where I found it. I just found it and it just like works. It's like a weird thing of mine.
Wow. That's a secret to take to the grave, I guess. Yeah.
I mean, I've said it before. It's just a number, but it's just works for me.
And so obviously there's sampling and then there's adding stuff on top. How does playing
layering's everything. That's what stops it from sounding like, you know, just the 90s or just sounding like I layer all my kicks, all my like a lot of my snares, sometimes the hi-hats, but it's like I have a couple different methods. I tune a lot of 808s to go with the sample. That's like my kind of thing. Mm-hmm. I don't always do it, but a lot of times.
Right. I saw that to kind of bring out the bass line, right?
Yeah.
You'll take the
it's a different kind of sound, and no one really does it. Obviously, in like trap beats, they do tune to 808s, but I'm talking about tuning the 808 exactly to a sample and following it. It's like, I don't see anybody else doing that.
Yeah. You'll add keyboard, organ sounds.
Yeah, I have
to
a
stuff.
Lot of live players that come in though. Sometimes I'll play it, but I have like live horns that come through. I have live piano, bass, all that.
And how does that work? How much do you direct them? How much do you let them do their thing?
I mean, with the bass player, like shout to Brady Watt, I let him just do his thing.
Highly sought after session bassist who has worked with Currency, Smoke Dizza, Talib Kweli, Joey Badass, Gene Gray, and many more.
But like with the keys and the horns, I usually direct it all. That's what producing is, really.
Yeah. You work with so many vocalists.
Right.
So many vocalists. I assume you're vocal producing with all of them.
Absolutely.
How did you learn to do that, to coax performances out of
people? I'm still getting better. I mean, you never stop learning. But I think on Joey's new album, working on All American Badass, I learned a lot. Like shout to Muppets Never Die 1900. He's really dope at that. He made Joey, you know, a song like Devastated is so well vocally produced. Being there for like the transformation of that, going from like a song that wasn't all that to being like a almost platinum record. It's crazy.
What's your best trick? Is it, hey, this one's just for warming up or?
Nah, not at all. I like people that be prepared, but lately I haven't been having people right in the room with me as much as I used to. But Joey always does. He's probably one of the fastest. Freeway's always, like Freeway's one of the fastest people I've ever seen make a song like from scratch. Bun B, Styles P. Obviously Black Dot always does it in one take, but you know, I never see him actually write the rhyme. I don't know his writing process. Freeway got a gift the way he like, I literally seen him make a whole song about what was going on at that moment and be ready to record in 5 minutes. Like craziness.
Amazing. And you actually rap once in your catalog,
a couple times.
I heard it on The Best.
The Best, and that's word to my mama. 2010 ain't no more drama. Word to Obama, a new day dawning. I wake up to make beats every morning.
Yep, and also on the end of DJ Save My Life, there's a secret song.
A love lost is a love found. In my case, it was the love for the underground. Got jaded when it showed its true colors. Found true friends, had to brush off the others.
Did you ever want to get on the mic yourself?
When I was a kid, I used to call up radio stations and rap and shit. Herb shit.
I noticed you were on John Connor very early.
I'm about the throne, nigga, that's my seat. I'm a son, you niggas, how about I get you a high seat and a fucking high seat? All Varsity Blue City Club, that be the posse.
Static Selecta worked with Flint, Michigan rapper John Connor as early as 2011 on the song Sam Jack. 2 years later, Connor was signed to Dr. Dre.
Everybody early. Name someone who I wasn't.
Right.
Like, the only people I regret, I feel like I could have got a lot cooler with Kendrick earlier. And that kind of, it ruined like more of the chance of us working together. Not saying it couldn't happen. Like when I see him, it's always love. But like when I first met him, he'd be like, oh, what up? Like showing mad love. Now we see each other. It's like, hey, what's up? Cool. You know, I don't think I was one of the guys that broke him. You know what I mean? Like I would never take credit for that. But pretty much almost everybody else, I was a major part of like a lot of these new guys' success.
I was wondering about that. You know, you see a Mac Miller or
Mac Gibbs, Joey Badass. Chance, Joey, yeah. Action, Westside Gunna Conway. I mean, obviously Term. Shit, who else? I mean, I could look at my
You can look around the room album, and see. Yeah. How do you know someone is worth working? I'm sure you've run across dozens or hundreds of rappers in a week.
My track record is like really good. Like there's a couple cats I put a lot of energy into that didn't pop off, but for the most part, like I'm not in the red. Yeah. I'm on a winning streak with that. Now I just got to like take more control of basically the paperwork when it's early enough to sign somebody.
Right.
That's what I'm looking for right now.
Do you know when you see someone who has potential? Can you put it into words?
There's only
like,
been a couple
what
people
you're looking
like,
for.
Like, I didn't know how big Wiz was going to be. Wiz was someone that, but I told him to his face. I was like, "Yo, I fronted on you and you proved me wrong." So I think he always respected that because I always kept it a buck with Wiz. You know, when he first signed to Warner, I wasn't really a fan, and then he did Kush and Orange Juice, and he found his sound. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Besides that, I don't know.
You'll see someone and you'll be like, "That's the guy. That's the person."
Yeah.
Wow. We should all be so lucky to be able to spot people at 16 or 18 years old working a lot with Pro Era these days.
Yep.
What's it like spending 200 days a year on the road with people?
We haven't done that in a while. Like that was like 2013, 2014, 2015.
But for a while,
the last couple of years, I didn't do the School Board Q tour, and I left the Logic tour. I left like 11 days in. Like mm-hmm. Joey's on tour right now, and I'm not there. But
right.
You know, I got the album. I got my kid at home. I got, you know, I think we had a great run. Obviously, we're going to keep working on music and all that, but I don't know how much I'm going to be on the road.
When you were doing that, what was it like to be around people who were 15
half
years your junior? Yeah,
yeah,
half your age.
I mean, it was like, it was crazy because, you know, I wanted to set a good example. I always set a good example hip-hop-wise to them. Like, I always, like, stood for the values and told them, like, yo, you shouldn't do this. You should do this. But as far as, like, I watched those kids turn from teenagers to grown men. And that, you know, I've never really got to do that to people that I just, you know, I met them in 2012. And then all of a sudden we're on the road for like over 600 gigs in a couple of years. It's like, it's crazy. So it's all a big family now. And just watching them all change, man, like me and Nick are real close. Me and CJ, obviously me and Joey are, that's a whole different thing. You know, like this guy, this is my little brother.
And did you change as a result of spending so much time with them?
Somewhat. I regret a lot of the shit I did. Like there was nights on tour, I was getting so drunk coming back to the bus, like not even knowing where I was. Like there was a point where we would just part. This was all before my obviously I had a kid and all that, but
right.
There was some nights we were wilding. Like Absol saved me a couple nights on tour, like where I'd get back to the bus and like not, I lost my wallet and my passport and like didn't have money to pay a cab. Like there was a couple of dark times there where I was like, I got to get it together,
yeah.
But not too many. And you got to realize too, we dealt with a lot of death, man.
Of course.
Steez, then Junior,
yeah.
And then even Sean Price and Prodigy, like, affected all of us.
About to one take this shit, nigga.
Pro Era member Capital Steez committed suicide on December 23rd, 2012. Joey Badass's cousin, Junior B, who acted as the crew's publicist and Joey's manager, died following injuries from a car accident a little less than 2 years later. Rapper Sean Price died in his sleep in the early morning hours of August 8th, 2015. And Mobb Deep's Prodigy passed away on June 20th of 2017.
Because, you know, me and Joey brought up, I mean, first of all, I'm talking about Sean Price and Prodigy were dear friends of mine. I'm just talking to the relationship between me and Pro Era.
Right.
Like, we brought Prodigy out for his last show in New York ever at Summer Jam. That was a couple days before he passed. Sean was rocking with us at my release party, you know, a couple days before he passed. Like, this is all, like, Joey knows Prodigy and Sean through me, you know what I mean? So it's like, the whole team, like, just dealt with so much death. And Junior was just such a, not for nothing, like, you know, Steez was such a bad hit, but it was before anyone blew up. You know what I mean? Junior passed, like, in the middle of, like, before the money about to come out and all this. Like, Junior was such a major part to everybody on the road and at home. Like, he lived with Joey and he was his cousin. It was just such a bad hit, man. And I think it left us all with, like, PTSD, bro. Like, I've had therapists tell me that, like, we went through a lot of shit in a short amount of time. From even being unknown to not, I'm not speaking of myself. I'm speaking of them. I, you know, they look at me like the guy that's been in the game forever. I'm like the older uncle. But I went from watching dudes be like 300 views to 30 million views, like, and going from doing the Knitting Factory to 100,000 people, like, it's crazy.
Yeah,
Coachella, the main stage, debuting, Devastated, like. I came from my grandmother's funeral. Never even heard Devastated because I didn't go to the rehearsals because I had to go to the funeral. And I literally walk on stage and we do this song for the first time in front of 200,000 people at Coachella. And now it's, like I said, about to be platinum. Like, it's crazy.
Steez, I mean, I only met him once. The way he saw things seemed so unique.
He was a deep thinker,
unique.
Man.
Yeah.
I probably only met him three times in my life. But one of those times was the day we did Like Water, Prelude 47, and we did one other joint.
And I quote, we came like them niggas in boats, still think it's a joke, your third eye vision is broke, we lifted from smoke and floating, that's how I got my aura open, check the horoscopes though, you can say I'm horoscoping. Let's escape into the universe, but let me show you how to do it first. Sit patient till you feel a tingling sensation. Don't start shaking, relax and try to take it. It's ecstasy, but mentally
and just let it be. Just watching him record, it was like, yo, this kid's gonna be special. So it hit me really hard when he passed, especially it was like Christmas Eve or something. Like, it just like, it was like, what the fuck? Like, he never even got his chance. He was gonna be very, very special, man.
One other thing you did on the road when you were touring a lot was you got to DJ during a lot of Tribe shows during their final
Yeah, that was my first full tour. In 2006, I DJed the 2K7, you know, like NBA 2K7.
Yeah.
The tour, it was Tribe Called Quest, Rhyme Fest, and I would open every night. Like, I would DJ between the groups, and me and Tip got really, really cool in that run. And we actually have my cousin's really good friends with him, like, mm-hmm. for years and years. So I didn't even bring that up at first. And then I brought it up later. He's like, why didn't you tell me that? And ever since then, Tip's been a big brother, man. Like, from touring, I went on a world tour with him when the Renaissance came out. We did Japan.
We're here downtown Tokyo, about to rock the show. Q-Tip. And we're heading out. Another date in Japan.
Australia, 26 cities in Europe, the U.S. Like, we did... We had a crazy, crazy run, and I'm excited for Tip's new album.
What was it like seeing Tribe? That would be the last run of shows, I think, that they ever...
Yeah, definitely. They did a couple towards the end.
Couple, yeah.
When I say the end, I mean before Fife passed.
Yeah.
We actually did Wireless, the same stage. It was Nas, Tribe, Jay-Z, and Justin Timberlake, and Joey. Crazy. In London. That was one of the last Tribe shows ever. It was crazy, man, because I grew up idolizing Tribe, like... studying all their music. Like, Scenario is one of the songs that got me into hip-hop. I was like 8 years old. To going on tour, and I actually performed Busta's verse on Scenario every night. It'd be like Q-Tip. If you go online and look up like Q-Tip live in like Paris or like England or whatever, it'll be like, listen to Scenario and it's me rapping Busta's verse. It'd be like, here's Static Select with the Scenario.
That's amazing. Yeah, and you did Rock the Bells with them during that same period.
I was there, like, all the... If you've seen... Obviously, a lot of people seen the documentary. Like, when they were fighting backstage, like, that was a lot of the nights that I was there.
I've never had a problem.
Fife had a problem with me.
If I'm asking you a something wrong, say it.
Dude, I'm in a group with you. You're not my dad.
You did one thing on one of your albums that completely blew me away, and I was wanted to know how the hell it happened. Which was getting Cassidy and Freeway on the same song.
That was
song.
The first song they did together after the, I think, ever.
Yeah, I'll show you how biscuit tastes. Trash bag, sticky tape, man, pick a lake. I'm getting cake on the corner usually, and I'll put you to sleep like a boring movie.
Cassidy, then an unknown 19-year-old, engaged in a now-famous battle with Freeway in New York City's Hit Factory studio back in 2001. Cassidy is generally acknowledged to have won. Freeway blamed his loss on having used all his best rhymes in a radio appearance earlier that day, and on the fact that the battle was a cappella, a format that didn't play to his strengths. Static reunited the two on his 2007 song, What Would You Do?
Music is the root of all evil, but my music reaching the people, so you can say whatever. If you ain't talking about that chatter, you ain't saying nothing. They say diamonds last forever, I'm a match forever. That's right, get cash forever.
You know what's funny is I had the idea and I completely forgot they had beef together. And I was like, oh, shit. And I told Free, and Free was like, yeah, you know, why not? It's been a minute. And then when he said that, I was like, oh, shit, I didn't even realize. And I was like, all right, well, now in my head, I'm like, Freeway did it. And he says Cassidy's name in the verse.
Pioneer, I am here for your last track climbing. For those who thought rapping was a pastime, it's perfect timing.
In the final version of the song, Freeway doesn't actually end up mentioning Cassidy's name.
I'm like, I hope Cass does it.
Yeah.
And Cass did it, man. Like, my first album was such an experience because it was like, you know, I got some names on there, and these are all dudes doing it for free, man, just like because I was holding down the music, like on the radio and the mixtapes and all that. Like, come on, man. Q-Tip, Styles, Talib Kweli, Consequence, Joell Ortiz, Kool G Rap, Sheik, Freeway, Cassidy, Royce, Cormega, Scram, Tony Touch, DJ Khaled.
Right, man, Khaled does AZ, that interlude Cormega. For you.
DJ Khaled is Static Selector. All you fake-ass DJs scared of break records and break new artists. Give it up, man. Straight up, man.
I remember Cormega's like, yo, I hate these beats, yo. He didn't even want to do it. Shout out to Cormega. That's fam. I was touring with him real early, too.
So when you're putting together one of the records under your name, the compilations, how does it work? When I talked to DJ EFN about his album, he said, I had a list of song titles and who I wanted on the songs before I started, and that was 90% the real album.
So I made a fictitious track listing, you know, like a wish list of, okay, these are the songs. These are tentative names for each song. This is the feel that I'm getting from the song. So these are the artists that I envision would sound good on the song.
Yeah, that's not how I work at all. That's not how mine work. My work, I think every album comes together different. I lived in Bushwick for like 7, 8 years. And that studio was so legendary because every day there was at least like 15 different like known rappers coming through. And it was like, that was a more organic thing. My new studio, you know, we're sitting in now, it's a lot smaller. And it's, you know, when I had my baby, we had to, her room was like where we did Before the Money. I did Detroit versus Everybody there. I did Action, Mr. Wonderful. Like all that was done in this room for 1 year between me moving from Bushwick to the kid being born.
Harley was born in July 2015.
That was a very specific year, and then I had to rush to get everything out of there to make it the baby's room. So I put it here, and I've been here since. And it's cool because I'm back in Bushwick. But you know, this room is like there's no booth. People just rap on the mic, and yo, bro, like so many records have been done right there with no booth. Like, you know, Super Predator, Legendary, 500 Benz. Shit, most of my new album 8, which comes out, you know. December 8th,
right?
I got a lot of people on there that recorded the verses in here. You know, a lot of records, man. Little Fame, P&B Rock was in here, you know, very early.
Yeah.
Prodigy, man, rest in peace. Sean Price. Sean Price never made it to the studio, but my actual crib, like he was there. I'd say he was there like 3 times a week right around the time he passed, man. So that was a super bad hit.
How does putting a record... I mean, I guess you said it's different every time, but like take the new one, for example. How does that come together? Do you have ideas for subject matter
different
or
records, like
song?
Different records come up different ways. Like the 2 Chainz Wiz Khalifa record, I just came up
the
with.
The man you a coward, I am. The man of the hour, I am. High as fuck off the joint that I just rolled. Riding round in the cloud of that Kush smoke. Put my generation.
I was like, I want 2 Chainz and Wiz Khalifa on that. It was just like an idea, and I sent it. Yo, I sent it to both of them, and like it took a long time for either one of them to like even give it attention. And then Chainz just sent me it one day randomly, and I sent it to Wiz, and Wiz sent it back like a day later. I was like, oh, thank God. Like, I got the first single for the album. And at that point, I don't think I had any other songs done for the album. Because last year, I announced the album with Smoke Break, which was me and Chainz' first song. And he ended up being like, yo, let's do a whole project. So we did that whole project before this album. Mm. This Man of the Hour was not from that, he did that for my album. The Run the Jewels record was
hey, static. Meet me at Max Pierce, man, like 2 a.m. I came up on some brain blown full of smoke, living in a terror dome. Bad kid, born to kill a king, but my hands shit. Put him up.
I was like, yo, can we do this song finally? Because we've been talking about it for years. We toured a lot together, like, they were on a lot of the festivals me and Joey were on, and I've known LP and Mike forever. The Action song on the album was for his album.
You know I gotta let these nuts hang. It feels like I've been sitting on a shelf, but I've been sitting on a couch, watching myself sit on the couch. All of a sudden I'm in Rome on the top floor. Your boy started feeling like a drone, hanging from the ceiling of the...
And I basically just asked for it and he gave it to me. Shout out to Action. But it's new though. It's not from any of the old... Sometimes I put old songs on, like Lucky 7 had a couple songs that were like sitting around for a while. This album don't really have that. I mean, obviously the Sean Price, Wise P song is 2 years old. They did it right before he passed.
I'm not your motherfucking friend, fam. Fuck the Kiki Bone Bone when the flim flam. I'm hot creepin', screed the faux faux, I've been bad. Let's get physical, pull the pistol from my gym bag. You deserve to have felons.
And before Wise went to jail, Wise is getting on March. Every other song on here is brand new.
Do you suggest, you know, topics or titles to people?
Yeah, I mean, the Lox record, I told them, like, keep it real, like, about hip-hop and about, like, just having that feeling.
Bumping that static with the automatic on my hip. Blue whip, navy paper plane, no, I ain't a crip. We used to have a hallway fogged up, smoking reefer. Yeah, I went to school, but KRS was the teacher. And April had the hustle.
Kid Jordan Lucas did the Don't Run record on his own. He just came up with the whole thing. He really did it amazing. He even, like, halfway through the song, the beat changes, he did that.
Will I ever tell a motherfucker bold face lie? But I might just hop up in the Bronco and make OJ drive. Damn it, I've been nothing but a fucker for my whole.
He basically slows the beat down 50% and goes in on it. The Raekwon and Goat and Royce joint, Royce came up with the hook and Raekwon just went in.
The smoke split, but see the difference can kill you whenever. Lay in Memphis. Nobody move, nobody get hurt. Everybody in war, nobody get hurt. Everybody bored, nobody in war.
The Be Real Everlast song, I had like the Cypress Hill. It's kind of like a tribute to DJ Muggs. I was like, let's do a Cypress Hill House of Pain record.
Life is all a dream. I used to read Hot Times magazine. Rolling trucks with send dog up in the limousine. Platinum plaques upon the wall. Every day, burn a sack, a static, you recall. Had the stash spot case we got
popped. Yeah. I'd say half and half. I came up with a lot of the ideas, though.
And, you know, obviously, when the last album came out, Lucky 7, you said, this is my last compilation album under my own name. I'm tired of waiting for verses from rappers.
I was just in a new phase, man. And Khaled turned that around. He was the inspiration behind this album, like when he started blowing up on Snapchat.
The key to more success is using the right soap. I only use Dove. Dove soap. Trust me. Trust me.
And he had the baby, and he was just so, like, in your face with everything. And he put out, he's put out two albums since I put out my last album.
Right.
And, you know, he's a friend of mine. I always see him running around, and he acts like he's fresh in the game, and he's been around for a long time. So he really influenced me doing another album. And my daughter, obviously.
Sure.
She explains it on the first
song. Hey, Harley, they really thought that was the last album?
Daddy.
What's the name of this one, baby?
I select a lot of things in my life.
Now, do you have intentions of becoming a bigger public personality in the way Khaled did?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, not to the level that he's doing.
Not exactly the way he is.
I
want
to do, like, I always looked at myself as, like, the balance to Khaled. Like, he would put out, like, a very mainstream hip-hop album, and I'd put out, like, the grimy version of it. But this one's a little bit more, I got G-Eazy and Wiz on it, you know what I mean? Like, this is, but it's still my style production. But this one's a little bit more clean, but there's the grimy records too. Like, you know, the video I just put out with West Side Gun and Conway in Term, there's a shooting in the video that actually happened while we were shooting the video. So there's still a lot of griminess on the album.
Right. We started this by kind of talking about growing up, your family, stuff like that. I've heard you mention your mom a lot over the years. Literally the only thing I've ever heard you say about your father is that he used to listen to Roy Orbison. What was your relationship?
When did I say
that?
He definitely did.
Yeah.
He was there when I was like real young. He was like really involved with bringing me to BMX. Like I used to race BMX, bring me to baseball, all that. He taught me like math really young. But, he's definitely been a huge influence on my life when it comes to book smarts, when it comes to technology, wiring things, math, like the way I sequence music, like a lot of that I learned from him at a young age, how to be like technical, like with tools, like building things. But my mom's always been like at the shows. Like my dad's came, I think he came to one show ever, and I appreciate that. You know, he comes from a whole different era. He was like the guy that was like, rap's a fad. And my mom was like, hey, do what you want to do. You know, yeah. Obviously,
like
he doesn't
we said,
feel
working DJing since you were 13, working in clubs since you were 15. Was there ever a point at which you're like, "Hey, I'm done. I got to quit and do something else."
Quit DJing?
Yeah,
never. God willing, I live to be an old man, but I'll be 85 years old DJing. Like, I never even wanted to like be a producer the way that. I mean, obviously, I wanted to be like Primo and Pete Rock and all these guys, but I never walked around saying I was a producer till like 2007, 2008, when I had to because of the mixtape game. That was really the reason for all this. But I've always been about DJing. That's my love. Like, I could play 70s records for the rest of my life and be fine.
Since we are sitting in Harley Harl's House of Hits,
yeah.
How has having a daughter changed things personally, musically?
It hasn't changed the sonics at all, but it's definitely changed the way I work now. Like, I say no a lot more. I stopped doing freebies a long time ago. Like, you know, there's certain people I always hook up, like Bun B, Free, you know, the Locks, people like that. Obviously, the family term and, you know, Rex and everybody. But I stopped doing the random shit. Like, I used to really look out for people a lot more and get shitted on. You know what I mean? Like, I'm done with all that. So now, if I put energy into something now, it got to be, it's a wiser decision. You know what I mean? Because I know what I'm doing. And I basically, you know, I don't fuck around as much. Like, I used to just wild out till 10 a.m. every day. And that was fun because I had no responsibilities besides my bills.
You have to be up in time to spend the next night.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I would, you know, the later I stayed up, the more money I make because the more music I would make. So it was cool. But now it's like, I want to, you know, I woke up at 9 a.m. today, 9 a.m. yesterday, 9 a.m. the day before to be with my daughter and play all day. Like, it's worth everything.
One or two final things. I was just curious, you know, you've sampled a lot of stuff and there was one very obvious one. Or maybe you replayed it, but the actual Mike Tyson punch-out music.
I don't take the name of gangsters, I've been warned. I done pushed weight from Boston to San Juan. Dealt with illegal bitches and firearms. When they flipped out in prison, I restored calm. Black gators on the feet.
Yeah, I got away with murder on that one.
Yeah. So
that wasn't a replay.
That wasn't. They never.
Shout to Nintendo for not. I think, hey, it's been 10 years, so I don't think you can do much now.
Right. Yeah, I was going to say, I'm not blowing
up. I'm sure they can still.
Hope I'm not blowing up your spot. I mean, the song's called Punch Out.
It's pretty fucking obvious.
Yeah.
I can't believe I got away with it. You know who I made that beat for?
Who's that?
Pardon me. 50 Cent.
Really?
He didn't fuck with it.
Too bad. I noticed the Get Rich or Die Tryin' plaque up there.
That was from the marketing days. Like, I did. All the New England marketing for G-Unit for years, from the beginning, from like Wangsta to shit, Bank's second album.
Wow.
Yeah,
that's
a lot of shit. I'd say G-Unit paid my rent for 5-6 years.
So marketing, you do like street team stuff?
Yeah, beyond that too, like radio, like we'd bring 50 to like the Reebok headquarters and organize events. Like, I was working real close with Chris Lighty and James Cruz. I was there when James did the deal with Vitamin Water. Water sold in bottles for $2. Coca-Cola came and
bought it for beans. What the fuck? Have a baby by me, baby. 50 Cent, with the guidance of the late Chris Lighty and his business partner James Cruz, who was the head of Violator Marketing Group, partnered with Vitamin Water for an unusual endorsement deal in 2004. Instead of paying 50 to be a spokesman for their new Formula 50 flavor, the company would give the rapper a stake in his ownership of the company Glasso. This turned out to be prescient when Glasso was bought by Coca-Cola for over $4 billion in May 2007. While 50's exact take from the deal is unknown, reports have his haul at somewhere between $60 and $100 million. Cruz is now the president of artist management and head of strategic partnerships at Combs Enterprises.
Shout out to James Cruz, man. To this day, we're good friends, and like, he's always been a huge inspiration in the industry, and like, he's also a great father and a family man. And I've been there with him for some crazy times, man. Like, when Get Rich or Die Tryin' came out, that was one of the favorite times of my life, man. Shout out to Kelly Wu.
Kelly Wu is currently at the Cashmere Marketing Agency, a, quote, lifestyle marketing collective. But before that, he was in radio promotions and guerrilla marketing at both Interscope and Priority. He started his career at the Gavin Report, a place you can hear all about in episode 122 with Tembisa Mshaka.
Shout out to Street Elements team in L.A. Shout out to the Show Off marketing team in Boston, man. My whole team, Brandon, Eddie Q, Edition, everybody that was around back then, it was like, we had fun, man.
So this kind of brings up a side thing. How do you market a tidal wave like Get Rich or Die Tryin'? Go shorty, it's your birthday.
We gonna party like it's your birthday. 50 Cent's 2003 debut, Get Rich or Die Tryin', sold 872,000 copies in its first week and almost as many in its second. It was the top-selling album of the year, selling 12 million copies worldwide.
Got to go so, like, we had to build that, you know what I mean? Like, I mean, it was easier when and the club came out, because that's one of the biggest impacts of any song ever. Like, I remember the DJ, shout out to Chubby Chubb. I went to the club the night it came out, and he played it for 25 minutes straight, and everybody danced the whole time. Like, 50 Cent's wave off the mixtapes was so crazy.
Yeah.
Shot to Jeff two times. I remember he gave me like a bunch of, he gave me a CD of like 50 Cent freestyles right when, like, his first songs he did after he got shot. And I was like, what the fuck is this? Like, it was just so different and crazy. And, you know, we would have to, they would send us like 10,000 mixtapes a week, and we'd have to get them to stores, like, to, for people to give out. We go to clothing stores, shout out to Manhattan's, shout out to High Voltage. Like, we go to all the stores in Boston and just give out boxes of CDs, and like, they couldn't keep them. Like, you couldn't even try to keep them. The kids would swarm in. We'd pull up Downtown Crossing with literally 5,000 CDs in the trunk of our SUV, and they would be gone. Like, in 2 seconds, kids would thousands of people would come up and take CDs. Like, 50 was that hot.
I remember I think I've lost one of the discs over the years, but I have an unofficial 3-disc, like, best of 50 Cent from that period.
That's it. That's the one they gave us so many. One. It's called the best of 50 Cent.
Yeah, it's like 3
Even
CDs
though the album wasn't even out yet, it was right. called the best of 50 Cent. And it had the Eminem freestyle, the "Don't think I won't shoot you because I'm popular.
I don't think I won't hit you because I'm popular. I got a P90 Ruger to pop at ya. Catch you slipping, I'm going to give you what I got for ya. My clip loaded with 16.
Yeah, had all that shit on it. Yo, that was a crazy time, man. And then going to 50's house for all the parties, you know, Mike Tyson's old house.
Yeah, you got a felony, but you ain't a predicate. Never the king of New York, you live in Connecticut.
Just as he was becoming a megastar, 50 Cent purchased a 50,000 square foot, 52-room house in Farmington, Connecticut that used to belong to Mike Tyson, though it was originally built for real estate mogul Benjamin Sisti. He paid over $4 million for it and then put about $10 million of renovations into it, but then sold it for a discounted price of just $8 million in 2016.
Shout out to Lloyd Banks, man. I got to hang out with him a couple weeks ago, and we were just reminiscing on some of that shit. You know, Prodigy was always there for all that, and Big Twin. It was just a crazy time, man.
It sounds it. I mean, I remember seeing it sort of from the outside, where Wankster was just the giantest record until the other.
It's crazy
because
looking back, that song's cool. I'm not crazy about that record, but yeah. Like the rest of the shit, Wankster was like, I was never really that crazy about the beat. But it was just anything 50 did was just out of here. And at the same time, he was going in on Ja and all them. Like, it was just so crazy. He didn't stop.
Finally, what do you want people to know about 8?
Just know it's the something for absolutely everybody on this album. Like, no matter what kind of hip hop you like, even jazz lovers, like, there's jazz all over the album. I always keep some horns and, you know, some jazz flavor on there. And, you know, it's my first time working with Roc Nation's managing me now. So just having that logo on there is crazy for me. And, you know, the Locks are on there, who Roc Nation. It's been a crazy ride, man. And this is like a big album for me because it's kind of the step to the next level. And when whatever's next, I have a couple things. You know, next up is the album 2 Chainz, which is going to be crazy.
Yeah, yeah. Damn right, bro. 4 a.m., I'm just getting started. For my birthday, I threw me a surprise party. Reminiscing about the trap playing the first quarter. My life changed when I had my first daughter.
Static told Billboard that on their upcoming joint album, 2 Chainz is, quote, rapping like he's from Brooklyn.
But everything about to happen is like, this is like the new stepping stone for it. So I'm just excited about this album.
Well, thanks for doing this, man. I appreciate it.
Static has a unique place in hip hop. As a talent scout, a DJ, and a producer, he's done his best to make sure that his vision of hip hop and the rules and ethics that go along with it continue to have an important place in the conversation. And he makes great music to help prove his point. As you were probably able to tell, I always love reminiscing about the Boston that Static and I both remember. But even more important than tales of Lansdowne Street brawls, I think what Static gave us is a sense of what that scene was really like from his perspective and who the important players were. Join us next week when our guest will be Percy P. We went to the Bronx legend's childhood home to talk Park Jams, his famous battle with Lord Finesse, working with Madlib, and a whole lot else besides. This is one not to be missed. To make sure you hear each episode of The Cypher as soon as it comes out, subscribe on iTunes or whatever podcast app you use. Make sure you check out our archives when you're there. If you like this episode, you should listen to our interview with another DJ and producer with a thing for mixtapes, J Period, on episode 179. By the way, if you use Apple's podcast to listen, go now and give us a rating and a review. It's by far the easiest way to help us out, which is why every podcast you listen to wants you to do it. Seriously, go now and do it. And you can really help us by becoming a patron. Visit us at patreon.com/thecyphershow and sign up. Bringing you a weekly show takes at least 20 hours of work, and we could really use the support. If even 20% of you gave us just a buck a month, I'd be able to afford a trip to see the Sox at Fenway. As an added bonus for our patrons, every month we share bonus audio that we get from our guests, either while talking to them after the main interview is over, or sometimes when they give us some extra special material. We've had behind-the-scenes production stories, unreleased Wu-Tang, and all sorts of things you can never find anywhere else, even on our regular episodes. Join us by the end of December to have access to January's file. You can find us at The Cypher Show on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Follow us and let us know what you thought of this episode and who you'd like to see on the show in the future. More information about anything related to the podcast, playlists, our complete archives, and more can be found for free at thecyphershow.com. The Cypher is created and written by Sean Sotero.
Absol saved me a couple nights on tour.
The show is produced and engineered by Josh Cross at Crosstown Studios.
He was the one telling me my beats sucked when I was in high school.
Our music is by 42 Ghosts.
Yo, I hate these beats, yo.
Our web guru is Aaron Young.
Probably some of the wildest shit ever in my life.
Audio editing by Rob Van Branken.
My great uncle taught Babe Ruth how to play baseball.
Special thanks to Patreon supporter Jeffrey Gilberts.
That's what producing is, really.
We'll see you next time around on The Cypher.
Their bags was somewhere else, and we went to like a bar to play pool, and they disappeared. And it was a bad neighborhood, and I was really worried about them.